Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, Greg Bowman will be speaking on Shakespeare, on love and marriage. So let's listen in on Greg.
I put those two terms together, love and marriage, although I'm not so sure that they necessarily would go together with Shakespeare. Depending on where the marriage is in the play, is usually a good indication of how you can tell if it's a comedy or a tragedy. Shakespeare comes at the end, it's a comedy. If the marriage comes at the end, it's a comedy. If Shakespeare puts the marriage at the beginning, it's a tragedy. And I'm not exactly sure why this is so, but if you think about the plays, if you're familiar with some plays, if you think about them, you know, Romeo and Juliet, it's about as far into the play, the marriage is about as far into the play as you'll get for a tragedy. At Othello, it occurs at the beginning. For Macbeth, they're already married and they sort of grow apart through the course of the play. Hamlet, of course, starts with the marriage that is the problem with Hamlet and ends in a disaster at the end. I'm not sure exactly what this says about Shakespeare or what this says about our society. We do live in a society, it seems to me, where the focus is more on the wedding than it is on the marriage. When two people are getting married, Luke can bear me out on this, the pastoral counseling, pastors might have a difficult time getting them to focus on the marriage as much as they get to focus on the wedding. And it also seems to me that when we ask questions about people, when we want to hear their story, when we want to hear how they came together, we ask about the courtship. We don't necessarily ask about the marriage. How are you doing today? Is considered a rude question, but how did you meet? Is a good get to know you question. In looking at Shakespeare, that I'm interested in looking at how he bears to what he tells us today. Again, what he tells us about family values. I am going to focus more on the comedies than on the tragedies, because I do think that the tragedies, while they are about married couples, aren't necessarily about marriages, whereas the comedies at least gives us some hint of what goes on in a relationship, especially as they're wooing. But as we're looking at these, I want to ask if you think that it is true that Shakespeare, as he's often been called, is timeless. Ben Jonson started this propaganda by writing in the foreword to the publication of the plays that Shakespeare was not of his age but for all time, and people, when they often refer to Shakespeare, they will say that they are amazed at just how timeless Shakespeare is. And I'm not necessarily sure that this is true, and I want to look at some scenes to see how this bears out.
I think if you ask any teenager, they'd be real straightforward about it.
Yes,
they find him a foreign language.
Yeah, but I'm not just talking about the language, though, but just talking about
the
characters,
right?
Some of the concepts, some of the characters. I'm not so sure exactly how timeless it is. On the other hand, you know, who knows? I want to start with a little bit from Twelfth Night. I have passed out some copies, and if you have some copies, or if you can look on, that's fine. If you can't, we'll try to read these passages aloud so that you can at least hear what some of these things are. Twelfth Night. The title refers to the Feast of Twelfth Night, which is just the last night before Epiphany. Doesn't necessarily refer to the time frame of the play, but it evokes a time of fooling around. What we might call April Fool's Day was what they would call Twelfth Night. A time when things are topsy-turvy, when things don't necessarily seem to be right in the world, and it really is a time for foolery, and there's a lot of fooling that goes around in this play before we finally get to a resolution. The Duke, who is the highest nobility in this play, begins this play with a speech on music and on love. He says, "If music be the food of love, play on. Give me excess of it, that surfeiting the appetite may sicken and so die." That strain, again, you can imagine, too, that he's just lounging around. I've seen this portrayed. He's lounging in a chair with his court around him, and he's listening to these musicians, and he's just encouraging them, sort of reveling in the Epicurean moment. He says, "That strain, again, it had a dying fall. Oh, it came o'er my ear like the sweet sound that breathes upon a bank of violets, stealing and giving odor. Enough, no more. 'Tis not so sweet now as it was before. O Spirit of love, how quick and fresh art thou, that notwithstanding thy capacity receiveth as the sea, not enters there of what validity and pitch soe'er, but falls into abatement and low price, even in a minute. So full of shapes is fancy that alone it alone is high, fantastical. This guy can't seem to make up his mind. In the one minute, he's saying, if music be the food of love, play on, give me excess of it. And 10 seconds later, he's saying, that's enough. There's nothing, just like the sea, nothing enters but soon falls into abatement and low price, even in a minute. You know, 1 minute you want excess of it, 1 minute you don't. It seems to me that Orsino's speech here is very typical of the male attitude towards love in Shakespeare. What Orsino is saying is that I want excess of it in 1 minute, and I don't want anything to do with it in the next minute. The males in Shakespeare typically are not constant, and this is a very radical idea for Shakespeare's time. The propaganda of the age was that it was a woman who was inconstant, but in Shakespeare it is the males who are inconstant. If you think about the plays that you may be familiar with, A Midsummer Night's Dream may be the most accessible example. I'm going to draw this out. You have two characters, Helena and Hermia. See if I can remember this. Let's see, Helena goes with... No, it's the other way. Helena goes with Demetrius. And she's in love with Demetrius. Hermia is in love with Lysander. And these two guys are basically interchangeable. You could substitute one for the other. They seem to be the same character. Helena and Hermia are very clear descriptions. Hermia is a short, dark-haired. Helena is tall and blonde-haired. But throughout the whole play, their love is always towards the same guy. Now, at the beginning of the play, both of these men are in love with Hermia. Okay. And through the course of the play, Shakespeare resorts to trickery here. Through a magical eye juice, Lysander finds himself suddenly in love with Helena. And this is a source of great fun. You know, you have Helena, who's in love with Demetrius, who's in love with Hermia, who's in love with Lysander, who's in love with Helena. And you sort of have this square of them all four chasing each other around and, you know, spurning the person behind them and pursuing the person ahead of them. But then when everything gets resolved, the fairy king whose henchman is responsible for this mix-up, he says, go and resolve this, and Jack shall have it. Jill puts the eye juice in the correct eyes, then these go back and forth so that you end up with two full couples. But the women never change throughout this. And you'll find this true throughout Shakespeare, is that the women, if they're in love with a man, they're always in love with a man, and they're all in love with the same man. And it is the men who go from one to the other. And I think Orsino sort of indicates this. This is a pretty radical idea, like I was saying, for the time. This is not what was conventional. And I think it shows Shakespeare, at least, to be, in some sense, more modern. But in other senses, I'm not so sure exactly what to say about his portrayal of women.
Greg, I was curious about your comment or implication that women were not the faithful ones at that time in society.
Yeah, that's not true, but I'm saying that was the convention. Men would always, when they were writing the poetry, they would always say, how inconstant it is for you know, my wife is as inconstant as the moon. They were afraid of being cuckolded. It was a source of a poetic convention, and he's going against the convention here. I'm not saying that was what was true. What I'm saying is that was, if you read the literature written by men at the time, that was how they portrayed women in the literature.
I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, it's one of the things that's really disturbing about medieval and Renaissance poetry, is that they resort to this convention, especially when you see in the drama, it doesn't, at least in Shakespeare's conception, it doesn't appear to be true. Some of the men are just downright nasty, and you wonder exactly why these women want to maintain their faithfulness to them. The much ado that I'm going to show portions of, I'm not going to show the portion that has a real nasty wedding scene in which one man believes that his wife has been unfaithful, and he shames her publicly at a wedding, and gets physically abusive and then goes off. And then there's a redemption scene where he discovers that he was wrong. She hasn't been unfaithful. He takes her back. At which point, one of my professors has said, "You wonder why in the world she ever wanted him back." After that, so I'm not exactly sure that again, this is something that's timeless. One thing that I have noticed here again is another example of what goes on, a male attitude towards love. This isn't A Midsummer Night's Dream. This is something that I can compare to. A standard cliche of today. You have what I call the running out of gas scene. In A Midsummer Night's Dream, I've told you Lysander and Hermia start out in love with each other. Demetrius is also in love with Hermia and following them into the woods. Demetrius has the blessing of Hermia's father. And so Demetrius is the man that Hermia's father wants her to marry, but Lysander is the man that she wants to marry, and because she can't go against her father's wishes, according to the law of Athens, she agrees to elope with Lysander. He says he's got an aunt in the woods, we can remove there, and from there we can build our own society, our own love. And she follows him into the woods, and this is Act 2, Scene 2, about line 35 of A Midsummer Night's Dream, where Lysander says, as they're wandering around this woods, he says, "Fair love, you faint with wandering in the wood, and to speak troth, I have forgot our way. We'll rest us, Hermia, if you think it good, and tarry here for the comfort of the day." Hermia replies, "Be it so, Lysander, find you out a bed, for I upon this bank will rest my head. I'm going to lie here, you find somewhere else." And he says, "Well, one turf shall serve as pillow for us both, one heart, one bed, two bosoms, and one troth." And she says, "Nay, good Lysander, for my sake, my dear, lie further off yet. Do not lie so near." And I see this as the running out of gas cliche, where we're on our way through the woods, and oh gosh, I forgot my way. I run out of gas. What are we going to do? But again, this seems to be a male thing, and the woman sees. In these plays, is responsible for saying nay, lie further off. Okay, well, I'm going to now show a part of the tape from Much Ado, which I want to spend most of the time today focusing on. This is the initial scene. This is the initial wooing scene, and I want to get a sense too of exactly what the women and the men's attitude towards love here, of what's going on. They left out a joke, and I'm going to tell you exactly what the joke is that they left out. And again, thinking about this in terms of how this plays to a modern audience, if Shakespeare is indeed timeless, does this have anything to say to us after all of these years? This is a scene, if you're following in Much Ado, this is from the very first scene. Probably around line 100 or so. It'll vary in different texts because this Much Ado is mostly prose, and the line first change. But this is towards the very beginning of this.
"My lord,
I think this is your daughter.
My mother had many times told me so."
Were you in doubt, sir, that you asked
her? "Signor Benedict, no."
Okay, if you can hear this, "I believe this is your daughter," he says. This is the prince on the right, again, the highest nobility in the play. And his response, and this is a common response in Shakespeare when asked, "Is this your child?" The response is, "Well, her mother hath many times told me so." And then the Benedict makes a joke and says, "Were you in doubt, sir, that you needed to ask her? Ha, ha, ha." And he responds, "Why, no, Senior Benedict," and the line that they cut out is that he says, "No, Senior Benedict, for then you were but a child." In other words, you know, I didn't have any worry about you then, but now, who knows? And Brennan decided to cut that out. Go back a little bit, and we'll go on.
"Were you in doubt, sir, that you asked her?"
"Senior Benedict, no."
"That she would not have his head on her shoulders for all to see now, as likely as she is."
"I wonder that you will still be talking, Signor Benedict. Nobody marks you."
"What? My my dear Lady Disdain.
Are you yet living?
Is it possible Disdain should die while she has such meat food to feed it as Signor Benedict? Courtesy itself must convert to Disdain if you come in her presence.
Then is courtesy a turncoat? But it is certain I am loved of all ladies, only you excepted, and I would I could find in my heart that I had not a hard heart, for truly I love none.
A dear happiness to women. They would else be troubled with a pernicious suitor. I thank God in my cold blood I am of your humour for that. I had rather hear my dog bark at a crow than a man swear he loves me.
God keep your ladyship still in that mind, so some gentleman or other shall scape a predestinate scratched face.
Scratching could not make it worse than for such a face as yours were.
You are a rare parrot, teacher.
A bird of my tongue is better than a beast of yours.
I would my horse have the speed of your tongue. Keep your way in God's name, I have done.
You always end with a jade's trick.
You always end with a jade's trick. The man gets the last word in this. I mean, it's almost, this is a public... This is a flighting. This is a flighting is a public war of wits. It's an old tradition. I call it flighting. I think that's is that the old English term? That maybe even go back to Greek. But it's a war of wits. It's a public battle. And he ends with a jade's trick. In other words, he gets in his line, and then he says, "Oh, game's over. I win."
And we don't do that now.
Yeah, and she says, you know, you always end with a jade's trick. It almost gives you a sense that there's some sort of background of a relationship between them. It's remarkable just exactly how much this is like a similar scene in an earlier Shakespeare play. Does anybody know? The Taming of the Shrew.
Yes.
This is almost exactly like it, but he's toned it down a little bit. I mean, Beatrice... if you polled Shakespeare readers, Beatrice, I think, would come across much more sympathetically than Catherine would, or Kate, as she's called, in The Taming of the Shrew. He seems to have matured. This was written after The Taming of the Shrew. He seems to have matured a little bit. But I want to look at that just for comparison. It's almost the exact same scene. Again, it's a flighting thing. Could I have a Kate, actually? Somebody who wants to read Kate with me? Any volunteers? I'll tell you where. It's in The Taming of the Shrew, or what some people call it, Taming of the Shrew. This is act, I had it here. 2, scene 2, line 180 or so. It must be Act 2, Scene 1, line 180 or so. Yeah, there it is. Act 2, Scene 1.
I don't have a line number.
Do you have a scene between Catherine and Petruchio?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Enter Katharina.
With Moral Kate?
Yes, exactly. Okay, listen to the temper of this War of the Words and see if you can catch some of the same jokes even. Good morrow, Kate, for that's your name, I hear.
Well, have you heard? Yet something hard of hearing. They call me Catherine. They do talk of me.
You lie, in faith. For you are called plain Kate, and Bonnie Kate, and sometimes Kate the Cursed. But Kate, the prettiest Kate in Christendom, Kate of Kate Hall, my super dainty Kate, for dainties are all Kates. And therefore, Kate, take this of me, Kate of my consolation, hearing thy mildness praised in every town. Ha ha ha, this is a joke. Thy virtue spoke of, and thy beauty sounded, yet not so deeply as to thee belongs. Myself am moved to woo thee for my wife.
Moved, in good time. Let him that moved you hither remove you hence. I knew you at the first. You were a movable.
The joke here is that a movable is a little piece of, it's like a footstool, something that you can move around. Why, what's a movable?
A joined stool.
Thou hast hit it. Come sit on me.
Asses are made to bear, and so are you.
Women are made to bear, and so are you.
No such jade as you, if me you mean.
Alas, good Kate, I will not burthen thee for knowing thee to be but young and light.
Too light for such a swain as you to catch, and yet as heavy as my weight should be.
Should buzz.
Well, tame, and like a buzzard.
Oh, slow-winged turtle, shall a buzzard take thee?
Aye, for a turtle, as he takes a buzzard.
Come, you wasp of faith, you are too angry.
If I be waspish, best beware my sting.
My remedy is then to pluck it out.
Aye, if the fool could find it where it lies.
Who knows not where a wasp does wear a sting? In his tail.
In his tongue.
Whose tongue?
Yours if you talk of tails, and so farewell.
Notice that, and this is the scene, almost the exact same scene, you know, the ending too. Yours, if you talk of tales, and so farewell. And here he gives the ending, you know, gosh, I've forgotten the line. I suppose we could run it back, but anyways, if I had such a tongue of yours, but I have done. In other words, he says that your tongue is too much. Here she almost gets the final word in, but yet Shakespeare continues the scene. Shakespeare doesn't let Petruchio let Catherine have the final word, and so he goes on. She says, yours if you talk of tails, and so farewell. What? With my tongue in your tail? Nay, come again. Good Kate, I am a gentleman.
That I'll try.
And she smacks him. I swear I'll cuff you if you strike again.
So may you lose your arms. If you strike me, you are no gentleman. And if no gentleman, why then no arms?
Meaning he won't have a coat of arms, because he won't be a gentleman. A herald, Kate? Oh, put me in thy books.
What is your crest? A Costco.
Sorry.
Your cordial, Signor Benedict.
A herald, Kate. Put me in thy books.
What is your crest? A cock's comb?
A combless cock. So Kate will be my hen.
No cock of mine. You crow too like a raven.
Nay, come, Kate, come. You must not look so sour.
It is my fashion when I see a crab.
Why, here's no crab, and therefore look not sour.
There is.
Then show it me.
Had I a glass, I would.
What? You mean my face?
Well aimed at such a young one.
Now, by St. George, I am too young for you.
Yet you are withered.
Tis with cares.
I care not.
Nay, hear you, Kate. In sooth, you scape not so.
I chafe you. If I tarry, let me go.
Now, you have to imagine this is not only a war of wits, but if this is well played, you'll have a physical battle as well, where he's trying to physically restrain her, keep her from leaving the room. And in the process, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor end up like chasing each other up on the roof. He's following her. In some of these, the line that's coming up, he's going to be saying, you know, look at how Kate walks with what princely gait, and if they've really had a battle or something and she's twisted her ankle or something, then at the time that he's saying that she's walking like this, and when he's making the comparison. But Petruchio goes on, she says, let me go, and he says, no, not a whit. I find you passing gentle. 'Twas told me you were rough and coy and sullen, and now I find report a very liar. For thou art pleasant, gamesome, passing courteous, but slow in speech. Yet, sweet as the springtime flowers, thou canst not frown, thou canst not look askance, nor bite the lip as angry wenches will, nor hast thou pleasure to be cross in talk, but thou with mildest entertain'st thy wooers, with gentle conference, soft and affable. Why does the world report that Kate doth limp? And here's where she's walking across. Oh, slanderous world, Kate, like the hazel twig, is straight and slender, and as brown in hue as hazelnuts, and sweeter than the kernels. Oh, let me see thee walk. Thou dost not halt.
Go, fool, and whom thou keep'st command.
Did ever Dian so become a grove as Kate this chamber with her princely gait? Oh, be thou Dian, and let me be, and let her be Kate, and let Kate be chaste, and Dian sportful.
Where did you study all this goodly speech?
It is extempore from my mother wit.
A witty mother, witless else her son.
Am I not wise?
Yes, keep you warm.
Marry, so I mean, sweet Catherine, in thy bed. And therefore, setting all this chat aside, thus in plain terms, your father has consented that you shall be my wife, your dowry agreed on, and will you, nill you, I will marry you. Now, Kate, I am a husband for your turn, for by this light whereby I see thy beauty that doth make me like thee well, thou must be married to no man but me, for I am he, am born to tame you, Kate, and bring you from a wild Kate to a Kate conformable as other household Kates. We can stop here. A lot of things that are echoed in this other scene. The one that I didn't stop to point out, where she talks about his face being a crab, in Much Ado, it's the scratching. I would not want a face where it is scratched as yours, or prevent that. I can sort of see echoes of Kate in The Taming of the Shrew. I'm sorry, in Much Ado About Nothing. But it's The Taming of the Shrew that really wants to jar our modern sensibilities. You know, there are things about this that we just think that, what in the world do we do with this? Before I go back to Much Ado, I want to touch on a final scene of Taming of the Shrew, which is the real problematic if you want to perform this. We performed this at Valpo my senior year, and we sort of ran over the possibilities. How in the world do you perform this final scene? Because Kate really has a problematic speech that will offend modern audiences. I've seen this portrayed where in the final scene Kate has been lobotomized. You can see the scar across, and that is the way that he's tamed her. I've also seen this, yeah. I've also seen this portrayed where Petruccio and Kate have a sort of private joke among them, where when they're in public, then she presents this face, but in private they sort of have this thing that is going on. It's a good modern interpretation, but I'm not sure that it's Shakespeare. Go ahead.
At Cornell, I saw them do it with her being behind the whole crowd, and she's giving this straight speech about how she's going to be submissive and all of that, mm-hmm. but she has this thing going with the audience.
Yes.
And so everyone else is taking it. Isn't it wonderful? She's finally tamed. She's going to be the good Kate, like all good household Kates. And she's winking and making these little remarks with her body language. And the audience is going crazy because she's the triumph. She's the one who triumphs. And in a sense, she's got Petruccio in her mm-hmm. her hand.
Well, let me read this final speech. Do you want to read it or do you want to?
Okay.
This is the very last scene. In my book, it's 134. Yes. It's the very end of Taming of the Shrew.
Oh, good. 5-5?
Yes, 5-5. And what has happened to set this up? He's finally returned to the house, and everybody's been married. They just had the marriage feast of the younger daughter. Now, Kate's the oldest daughter. They've had the marriage feast of the younger daughter, and they're seeing how they can be... lords as husbands, and each one has made a bet that they will send for their wife to come in to the room, and they all say Petruccio's wife, you know, she's such a shrew and has her own mind, she's not going to come at all, and so they wager something like 100 crowns, a lot of money, on this bet. And first person sends for his wife and she doesn't come, and he's surprised, and second person entreats his wife to come and she doesn't come, and he's surprised, and then they say, well, you know, of course, Kate's not going to come. And then here comes Kate, after she's sent for. And he even goes further and he says, you know, that hat becomes you not. Take it off and step on it. And she takes it off and steps on it. And the women say, gosh, let me never have cause to sigh till I be brought to such a silly pass. And another woman says, fie, fie, what foolish duty do you call this? And Petruccio says, I charge you now, Kate, to tell these women what their place is. And this is Kate's response.
5-5. Unknit that threatening, unkind brow, and dart not scornful glances from those eyes to wound thy lord, thy king, thy governor. It blots thy beauty as frost do bite the meads, confounds thy fame as whirlwinds shake fair buds. And in no sense is meet or amiable.
Amiable, yeah.
Amiable. A woman moved is like a fountain troubled, muddy, ill-seeming, thick, bereft of beauty. And while it is so, none so dry or thirsty will deign to sip or touch one drop of it. Thy husband is thy lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign, one that cares for thee. And for thy maintenance commits his body to painful labor both by land and sea, to watch the night in storms, the day in cold, whilst thou liest warm at home, safe and secure, and craves no other tribute at thy hands but love, fair looks, true obedience. Too little payment for so great a debt, such duty as the subject owes the prince, even such a woman oweth to her husband, and when she is froward, peevish, sullen, sour, and not obedient to his honest will, what is she but a foul, contending rebel, and graceless traitor to her loving lord? I am ashamed that women are so simple, who offer war or seek for rule, supremacy, and sway, when they are bound to serve, love, and obey. Why are our bodies soft and weak and smooth, unapt to conditions in our hearts should well agree with our external parts. Come, come, you froward and unable worms. My mind hath been as big as one of yours. My heart is great, my reason haply more, to bandy word for word and frown for frown. But now I see our lances are but straws. Our strength is weak, our weakness past compare, the seeming to be most which we indeed least are. Then veil your stomachs, for it is no boot, and place your hands below your husband's foot, in token of which duty, if he please, my hand is ready, may it do him ease.
And his response is, why, there's a wench. You know, what do you...
Kiss me, baby.
What do you make of this? Yeah. Is this not of an age, but for all time?
Why, it's a foretaste of the feast to come.
One comment about this: Shakespeare knows his Bible. Does this? Those of you who are biblical scholars know some of the places where this is coming from.
Sure.
Yeah.
Ephesians 5.
Which is read at more than a few weddings that I've been to, actually.
And misinterpreted by preacher after preacher.
Well, that I wouldn't know about. The other thing. The other thing that it's reminded, she's echoing when she says, thy husband is thy lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign, one that cares for thee. She's sort of echoing something that Petruchio says earlier in the play when he says, during his own marriage, he says, I will be master of what is mine own. She, meaning Kate, she is my goods, my chattel, she is my house, my household stuff, my field, my barn, my horse, my ox, my ass, my anything. This is an echo of the 10th commandment. My goods, my chattel, my house, my household stuff, my field, my barn, my horse, my ox, my ass, my anything. And I'm not exactly sure why he echoes the 10th commandment here, or what he's trying to say, But again, this really jars in the modern sensibility. Well, he's tamed this down now a little bit when he gets to Much Ado About Nothing, and he really gives Beatrice, although Beatrice is a quick-tongued woman, he gives her a lot more depth than at least what Kate has given. And I think as a result, it makes Much Ado a little bit more easier to play. But there are still some problems, and in the time that we have left, I'd like to point some of them out and see if these things jar modern sensibilities as well. Let me fast forward a little bit to the scene between Beatrice and Don Pedro. And this is, as Kenneth Branagh portrays this is really a touching scene. Branagh, meaning Branagh the director now, not the actor, he gives Kate much more... much more sympathy than might normally be thought of, even though you wonder about some of the...
Windy side of hair. My cousin tells him in his ear that he is in her heart.
And so she doth, cousin.
Good Lord, for alliance. Thus goes everyone to the world but I am sunburned. I may sit in a corner and cry hey-ho for a husband.
Lady Beatrice, I will get you one.
I'd rather have one of your father's getting. Had your grace never a brother like you?
The joke there, be getting. Well, I'd rather have one of your father's be getting.
Right. Come on. Excellent husband. If a maid could come by them.
Will you have me, lady?
No, my lord. Unless I might have another for working days. Your grace is too costly to wear every day.
Nice?
I beseech your grace, pardon me. I was born to speak all mirth and no matter.
Your silence most offends me. And to be merry best becomes you, for out of question you were born in a merry hour.
No. Sure, my lord. My mother cried. But then there was a star.
I mean, that really, if it's played well, and I don't think that they're getting away from the text in this. If this is played well, it really adds a lot of depth to her. I mean, you see some sort of sadness in the fact that she is thought of as always being married. You know, it has its downsides as well. The other thing that I like about that scene is that, and this can be interpreted in various ways, does Don Pedro, who is really high nobility, is he wooing her in that, or is he not being serious? It seems to me that he was almost being serious in that, and she looks at him and decides to make a joke. No, I'd rather not have you because you're too costly to wear every day. You're just for Sundays only. If I could have another one for working days, then I would have you. The scene that I want to play in its entirety, and this is rather long, is the courtship scene. Shakespeare, when he wants characters to fall in love, he will resort to a trick. Sometimes it's in the form of a bed trick, and that he starts actually in this. He starts that in this play. A bed trick is where one character, under the guise of another, goes to bed with someone, and the person is not wiser. And he uses this as a plot device. And this is in some ways, it's kind of a disturbing plot device. But he uses this in a lot of his later plays to preserve the honor of a woman, so that she can marry somebody else. You always have. When you use the bed trick, you have a man lusting after a woman. In one case, it's even a nun. And so he won't, in the play that I'm thinking of, which is Measure for Measure, Claudio won't release the woman's brother from prison unless she goes to bed with him. But what she does instead, Isabella, she substitutes someone else that he had dumped years ago into that bed. And therefore, then Claudio has to, or is it Angelo, I guess? It's Angelo, has to marry this one woman, and it leaves Isabella free to marry somebody else. This is a kind of disturbing device. This also occurs in Much Ado in a different way. There, a man is betting a maidservant, but makes watchers on. You wonder what these people are doing under the window to begin with. But he makes the watchers on believe that he is actually courting someone who's about to be married, and so it makes for a disturbing scene later on, and that's the device that Shakespeare uses, sort of trickery to involve true love. And you wonder too exactly how long these marriages will last. Well, maybe this is why the play is cut off at the marriage, because if these marriages are based on trickery, you have to wonder. Anyways, this is the trickery that is involved in getting Beatrice to love Benedict after they've sworn to give away.
Come hither, Leonardo. What was it you told me of today? That your niece, Beatrice, was in love with Signor Benedict?
I did never think that lady would have loved any man.
No, nor I neither. But most wonderful that she should so dote on Signor Benedict, whom she has in all outward behaviors seen ever to abhor.
Maybe she don't, but counterfeit.
Faith, like enough.
Oh, God! Counterfeit?
There was never counterfeit of passion came so near the life of passion, and she discovered it.
What? What effects of passion shows she?
Well, this fish will bite. What effects, my lord? You heard my daughter tell you how?
She did indeed.
How? I pray you. You amaze me. Oh, I should think this a trick. But the gray bearded fellow speaks it.
Has she made her affection known to Benedict?
No. Well, she now will. That's her torment. Hew me up 20 times a night, and there will she sit in her smock till she has writ a sheet of paper.
Then down upon her knees she falls, weeps, sobs, beats her heart, tears her hair, curses. Oh, sweet Benedict, go
does indeed. My daughter says so. My daughter is sometimes afeard that she will do a desperate outrage to herself. It is very true.
It were good that Benedict knew of it.
What else? You would make one a sport for men the poor lady worse.
I'm sorry for her.
I pray you, tell Benedict of it and hear what he will say.
What a good thing you.
Hero thinks surely she will die. Oh, she says she will die if he loves her enough, and she will die if she make her love known, and she will die if he woo her.
If she should make tender of her love, 'tis very possible he'll scorn it, for the man, as you know all, hath a contemptible spirit.
Oh!
I love Benedict well, and I could wish he would modestly examine himself to see how much he is unworthy so good a lady.
Well, when you walk, dinner is ready.
If you do not dote on her promise, I will never trust my expectations.
If the same neck be straight for her, that must your daughter and a gentlewoman carry. Let us send Beatrice to call them in to dinner.
This can be no trick. The conference was sadly bored. They have the truth of this from Hero.
They say I will bear myself proudly if I perceive the love come from her. They say, too, that she will rather die than give any sign of affection. I did never think to marry.
I must not seem proud.
Happy are they that hear their detractions and can put them to mending. They say the lady is fair, 'tis a truth, I can bear the witness, and virtuous is so. I cannot reprove it, and wise.
But for loving me, by my truth, it is no addition to her wit,
nor no great argument of her folly, for I will be wholly in love with her.
I may, Charles, have some odd quirks and remnants of wit broken on me because I have railed so long against marriage.
But that's not the appetite alter. A man loves the meat in his youth that he cannot endure in his age. Shall these quips and sentences and paper bullets of the brain awe a man from the career of his humor? No! The world must be peopled!
How's that for a distinction?
I would die a bachelor. I did not think I should live till I were married. Here comes Beatrice. Mind this day, she's a fair lady.
I do spy some marks of love in her.
Against my will, I am sent to bid you come into dinner.
Fair Beatrice, I thank you for your pains.
I took no more pains for those thanks than you take pains to thank me. If it had been painful, I would not have come.
You take pleasure, then, in the message?
Yea, just so much as you may take upon a knife's point. You have no stomach, Signor? Fare you well.
Against my will, I am sent to bid you come in to dinner.
There's a double meaning in that.
But are you sure that Benedict loves Beatrice so entirely?
So says the prince and my new trousered lord.
And did they bid you tell her of it, madam?
They did entreat me to acquaint her of it. But I persuaded them, if they loved Benedict, to wish him restful with affection and never to let Beatrice know of it.
Why did you so? Don't rather gentlemen deserve as full as fortunate a bed as ever Beatrice shall catch?
Oh, God of love, I know he must deserve as much as may be yielded to a man. But nature never framed a woman's heart of prouder stuff than that of Beatrice. Disdain and scorn ride sparkling in her eyes, despising what they look on. And her wit values itself so highly that to her all matter else seems weak. She cannot love.
Sure, I think so. Get to her of it. Hear what you say.
No. Rather, I will go to Benedict and counsel him to fight against his passion.
Do not do your cousin such a wrong. She cannot be so much without true judgment, having so swift and excellent a wit as she is prized to have, as to refuse so rare a gentleman as you have
been. He's the only man of Italy. Always accepted, my dear Georgia.
When are you married, madam?
Why, every day.
Tomorrow! She's blind, I want you. We have caught her, madam.
If it proves so, then nothing goes by hat. Some keep it killed with arrows, some with traps.
If it proves so, then nothing goes by haps. Some Cupid kills with arrows, some with traps, is what she just said. Now, this last part of the scene that's coming up, Much Ado About Nothing is mostly written in prose. The only lines that Beatrice ever has in poetry are coming up in the whole play.
Is in mine ears. Can this be true? Stand I condemned for pride and scorn so much? Consent, farewell, and maiden pride, adieu. No glory lives behind the back of such. And Benedict, love on. I will requite thee. Taming my wild heart to thy loving hand. If thou dost love, my kindness shall incite thee to bind our loves up in a holy band. For others say thou dost deserve, and I believe it better than reportedly.
Goes a little overboard.
This is overdone.
Yeah.
But it's easily forgiven given the scene at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh.
Okay, well, enough of that.
Although, Greg, I've watched and I'm not misspeaking what Shakespeare is saying about love here and the trap and so forth, but I've watched many a junior high love affair begin at a Lutheran camp with an exchange of wit between male and female, in which such curses are flung at one another that you'd scarcely believe that these two would get together, and yet by the end of the week they're and afraid to part that they won't see each other.
And the other thing that reminds me too is the you know. Let's see. I take no pleasure in this. There's a double meaning in that. You replay every single word that somebody has said, and you try to figure out, okay, what does it mean to my best advantage?
It's also a very common theme, indeed, in modern movies, plays, and everything else, that the causticness of the relationship at first, and they get together. Spencer Tracy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're all play that.
Well, because of time, I'm going to skip a couple of scenes. There are some real precious ones in here. The one I'm going to skip is the chapel scene, which is their first real confrontation after they've been tricked into this. Where at the one hand, they're trying to struggle with this potential tragedy that has just occurred. You know, a man is just disgraced.
a hero in front of a crowd, and both of them believe that hero has been wronged. They're trying to cope with that, and yet at the same time they're trying to cope with their feelings. And it's a real touching scene, especially the way that they portray it, where you know she wants to say, you know, is it not so strange for me to say at this time that I do love you? A tragedy in one sense bringing them together. I'm going to go to the end to see how this is all borne out. What do I want here? 1:30:10. The other scene that I'm skipping is where he tries to write poetry and is incapable of it. Writing poetry is a disaster for Shakespeare heroes. They can't ever seem to get it right. But here's their final scene after everything has been resolved with a subplot. Then we get.
Which is Beatrice?
I answer to that name. What is your will?
Do not you love me?
Why no? No more than reason.
Why then your uncle and the prince and Claudio have been deceived. They swore you did.
Do not you love me?
Why no more than reason.
Why then my cousin, Margaret and Ursula are much deceived, for they did swear you did.
They swore you were almost sick for me.
They swore you were well nigh dead for me.
There's no such matter. Then you do not love me?
No, truly, but in friendly reliance.
Come, cousin, I'm sure you love the gentleman.
I'll be sworn upon it that he loves her, but he has a paper written in his hands, a molting sonnet of his own dual brain fashioned to Beatrice.
A miracle! He is our own hands against our hearts. Come, I will have thee. But by this light, I take thee for pity.
Oh. No!
I would not deny you, but by this good day, I yield upon great persuasion. And partly to save your life, for I was told you were in a consumption.
I will stop your mouth.
And he says, peace, I will stop your mouth. You know, now that they've agreed to get married, he says, peace, I will stop your mouth. With a kiss. I mean, this is a line from earlier in the play when Claudio is told to stop Hero's mouth with a kiss. And this is another common convention. But this is the part, again, where I find troubling if you think about the implications of this. In the play that I was talking about, Midsummer Night's Dream, once all this is sorted out, Jack has his Jill, and the couples are straightened out, we go to the final act. And I don't know, those of you who are familiar with the Midsummer Night's Dream, do you know that in the final act, when we have all of the couples who have just been married are watching a play, the women do not speak. The women have no speaking roles in the final act. We've just sorted out all of the problems, we've just gotten married, we're watching the play, and the women do not have a single speech in the fifth act. And that's what I think of, too, when I think, okay, now we're getting married, and he says, peace, I will stop your mouth. He means with a kiss, and it's all playful. But yet, I think that there's this undertone that, in some senses, can distress the modern sensibilities. I don't know. What am I reading too much into this? Am I raining on a parade?
Not at all. I think it's very much there. Mm-hmm. No more of your fast tongue and your witticisms and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Or thinking of yourself.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's implied that she's getting the price of marriage. I mean, she's making a trade here that she'll be quiet now because she's getting marriage.
Mm-hmm. And you almost wonder if the Kate speech, which ends Taming of the Shrew, is implicit then in the marriage that's going to come on. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's why we don't see the marriages in Shakespeare. Maybe we just see the court. That's why we just see the courtships. Because when the marriages are played out,
there's no tale to tell.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, I want to close with one other point. One thing that we have to remember is that in Shakespeare's time, the women were played by men's, by boys, by apprentices. And Shakespeare does like to have a lot of fun with this. Sometimes it's not as explicit in the text, but you can really see undertones of this. The common theory is that the actors would portray the women's roles, and then a couple of years later, when they've grown out of them, then they would play the men's roles and get both sides of the, say, the Romeo and Juliet equation. I want to give you some. I was talking about some undertones of the bodiness in Shakespeare last time. I want to give you some undertones too of what Shakespeare is doing with the women playing boys' parts. And again, this deals with exactly what men and women have to say about each other and with regards to relationships. This is in The Tempest. This is Act 3, Scene 1. Those of you who have copies of The Tempest, this is where Miranda and Ferdinand, again, are in a falling in love state, and they're about coming together. This is around line 40 or so, if you have a copy of The Tempest, Act 3, Scene 1. Where Ferdinand says, "What is your name?" Miranda replies, "Miranda." Ferdinand says, "Admired Miranda, indeed, the top of admiration, worth what's dearest to the world. Full many a lady I have eyed with best regard, and many a time the harmony of their tongues hath into bondage brought my too diligent ear. For several virtues have I liked several women, never any with so full soul, but some defect in her did quarrel with the noblest grace she owed, and put it to the foil. But you, oh you, so perfect and so peerless, are created of every creature's best." Interesting that Shakespeare has this essentially, this is a man saying this to a man or to a boy. You, oh you, so perfect and so peerless, are created of every creature's best. And Miranda replies, again, here's the double entendre, "I do not know one of my own sex. No woman's face remembers, save from my glass, mine own, nor have I seen more than I may call men than you, good friend, and dear father, and my dear father. How futures are abroad I am skillless of, but my modesty, the jewel in my dower, I would not wish any companion in the world but you, nor can imagine form a shape besides yourself to like of." I'm not bringing this up in terms of homosexuality, although some people have read this as such. But I'm bringing this up in that Shakespeare at times will play with the double entendre and say that, yes, there are these women out there, but the eye of perfection, at least you can say, well, from the man's point of view, but in the eye of perfection, it's a man seeing another man. And that might be the excess of love. It's a real tricky situation as to what to do with this. The guy who played Shakespeare last week came in and said that he had created women's roles that could be eventually played by women. In some senses, that is true. I mean, we've seen a very good production of a woman's role being played by a woman. But in the other sense, I think we also have to remember that Shakespeare was writing these roles not for women, but for boy actors. And that when he has women who are disguised as men, they're not putting on a disguise, but they're taking off a disguise. This is a common plot device. If you've read any of Shakespeare's comedies, you know that often you will find women disguised as men, and I really think that it's helpful to think of this not as putting on a disguise, but as taking off a disguise, and seeing what the relationship is with that.